This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. For their May issue, the writers and editors at Cincinnati Magazine went in search of all things bourbon, from its creation to its consumption. Joining us to explore the wonderful world of bourbon are Cincinnati Magazine dining editor Joanne Drilling, Chef Jackson Rouse from the Rookwood, and author Fred Minnick. He's the bourbon authority for the Kentucky Derby Museum, and he writes for several national magazines. His book, Bourbon Curious, A Simple Guide for the Savvy Drinker, is due out in August. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, Fred, I've heard the old saying that all bourbons are whiskey, but not all whiskeys are bourbons. So what makes a bourbon a bourbon?
Well, first of all, it has to be made in the United States. It has to come from at least 51% fermented corn mash. There's some other technical pieces to it, but the most important aspect is that it has to go into a new charred oak container, which a barrel, every single time. So in Scotland, for Scotch, they can use used barrels. In Canadian whiskey, they can use used barrels. In Irish whiskey, they can use used barrels. So to be bourbon, it has to go into virgin oak every single time, and that is what gives bourbon all of its color, a lot of its aromas, and it's what makes it so unique, so sweet, and so delicious.
And is there a certain amount of time it has to age for, Fred, before it can be considered bourbon? Or?
Well, it depends on what's on the label. If it just says bourbon on the label, then there is no time limit. But if it says straight bourbon, it has to be at least 2 years old. If it says bottled and bond bourbon, it has to be at least 4 years old. So it's kind of a mystery of what each particular category is. And that's what I dispel a lot in my next book, is a lot of those unknowns. Like, for example, a lot of people still think that bourbon has to be made in Kentucky. That's not true. There's actually really great bourbon being made in other parts of the country. New York's making good bourbon. Wyoming's making good bourbon. It just so happens that 95% of it's made right here in Kentucky.
Yeah, it's true, because I've run across some really good bourbon in Michigan. And Joanne, didn't you run across somebody who's has a distillery here in Ohio?
Yes, actually. They used to be right there by Listerman's, and they've moved to St. Bernard. But I think it's called Waterstone. I'm trying to remember. Woodstone Creek. Yeah. And they just do like little single barrels of, they might do a vodka one time. They might do a bourbon another time.
Jackson, you started out brewing beer, didn't you?
I definitely did. Definitely, yes.
So
yes.
How did you get into bourbon?
Well, it really kind of falls back on I'm from Northern Kentucky, so it fell back on my Kentucky heritage, really. And I've always done a lot of kind of farm the table Southern cooking, so it just kind of went hand in hand. I mean, without bourbon, you really don't have Southern food. It's that connection, one in one, and it really was a part of my life growing up. We didn't really. That was the number one spirit that we had in our house, and probably really the only one. So it's kind of historical as much as it is as a really like kind of a hobby at the same time as well too. So,
mm-hmm. Hey, Fred, in a nutshell, can you kind of tell us what the process is for making bourbon? I mean, this is really old school stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really begins in the cornfield. The majority of the corn grown for Kentucky bourbon is coming from Indiana and Kentucky. So it's a very local process. They'll take that corn, they'll mill it and they'll combine it with a malted barley and either a rye or wheat, and then they will cook it. And so it'll be kind of like, you're cooking grits or oatmeal at home, and you'll see it bubbling, and then it'll start fermenting. And during the fermentation process, it'll be anywhere for 3 days to 7 days. Each distiller has their own, style of fermentation. But that fermentation is essentially making beer. So the first step of making bourbon is a predominantly corn beer. And they will take that fermented mash and transition it over into a still. Now, there's no regulation on what type of still they have to use, but the majority of the Kentucky distillers are using what we call a column still. They will run it through that column still for the first time, and essentially, it's separating the liquid and the vapors to create spirit, and the spirit will drip off that still, and then they will take that spirit and then distill it again with either what they call a doubler or a thumper. Again, it depends on the distillery. And once they distill that, they put it, they'll either cut it with water or put it straight in the barrel. And so that, in a nutshell, is the production aspect of the production.
And if you ever
of how they all make it.
So. Yeah, and if you ever smell that fermented mash, you have to wonder how in the world do they get from that to bourbon, which actually smells
amazing.
Pretty good and tastes pretty good. It is amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's
kind of like I was saying. You know, there's a lot of bells and whistles that go along with this. Each distillery has their own, trademark recipes. But it really comes down to the barrel. When it goes into that barrel, it's clear as water from your tap. It doesn't, it has like a very vegetable smell to it. And the barrel acts as a filter. So it filters out a lot of those unwanted aromas that you get from, like, let's say, a moonshine. And it's also changing the color. So it's chemically changing the spirit, making it brown, kind of a brownish color. And that's because the barrel is porous, and just like a Brita filter, it's filtering out all the bad stuff and injecting the vanillins and a lot of the wood sugars that are naturally inside the barrel. So it's very fascinating. It's a mystery in many respects. There hasn't been a lot of study into how it actually happens inside the barrel. That's changing. Most of the studies are actually from the 50s to the 70s, and now you have distilleries starting to do their own little experiments. And so it's like this little subculture going on within a culture right now of like how important the barrel is to the distillery community.
So, Joanne, what prompted you to write the article about bourbon, and who are the lucky reporters who got to do this?
Well, every year, the year before, we kind of look at the coming year. We think about what we want each month's feature package to be. And this was an idea that I pitched. And, with these kinds of things, the whole staff comes together and we all take turns traveling and visiting and tasting. And I don't think there was one person who was like, no. Everyone was like, bourbon, yes. So I, of course, had no problem getting people, interested and excited about doing the research.
As you're looking at that, how much is this taking hold in Cincinnati?
Oh, it's definitely becoming a really big part of the culture. I mean, because it comes, with Northern Kentucky coming right up to Cincinnati, and New Riff obviously is this huge, beautiful new facility. They're getting started with their bourbon production, and I think it's definitely becoming a big part of our culture.
Well, how many places in town? Of course, you have Rookwood that's specializing
sure.
in bourbon, right?
Absolutely.
How many places in town, Rookwood, and how many others are specializing in bourbon now?
Well, we have a handful of bars, places like the Old Kentucky Bourbon Bar, where you can really go somewhere and try a whole bunch of different kinds of things. But we also have restaurants that have great bourbon programs, and Jackson's
right.
Rookwood is a really great example of that. And believe it or not, places like the Greyhound Tavern in Northern Kentucky, which isn't the hipster hangout. It's definitely,
right.
Old school, family friendly kind of thing, but they have a really nice
they
selection.
Do. A lot of Northern Kentucky old time places you would never think have a great bourbon selection.
Mm-hmm.
That's the great thing about being in Kentucky, I guess, is you can always find really great bourbon.
How you describe the bourbon selection at Rookwood?
It's eclectic. We try to keep it a little bit different than some of the local places. I'd say that we like rye a lot. Nothing's better than really having a properly made Sazerac. And I think really that might be our focus a lot. I know that most of the managers and the people that run there, that's probably our go-to at the end of the night. But just that little bite of the rye just is huge. And we cook with it a lot as well. It really kind of reflects really well with a lot of the food that I actually make at the Rookwood as well, too. So it's from our desserts to some of our entrees to some locally glazed pork shanks. It's pretty magical, needless to say.
So it's good to drink. It's good to cook with.
It's all the way around. And as far as going back to our brewing and talking about how great those barrels are, I mean, we're doing an experiment right now with Mad Tree. Tomorrow we release My Beer, Are You Ready for the Darkness? Bourbon Barrel Edition. So it's another amazing thing what a barrel can do to a beer, and a little bit of experiment and a lot of love into that beer for sure.
Fred, how many bourbon distillers are there in Kentucky?
Well, there are eight or nine core ones. There's been more than in the last few years. But there's been a lot open up, and actually Kentucky. Even though Cincinnati and Kentucky both claim New Riff, that's one of the fun ones that I've that have opened up. That distillery is beautiful. I wrote a story about them. I think that is one of the up-and-come distilleries of the country. But, you know, there are really 8 or 9 core ones. You know, the rest of them are very small players, you know, with limited capacity. But then you have, you know, like New Riff, which has the ability to be, you know, to be a major player. They're kind of teetering on that edge right now. They consider themselves a craft distillery, but it, when in fact they really, really are kind of on that edge. Their column still is about 24 inches in diameter. To put it in perspective, you know, Maker's Mark, you know, their column inch stills 36 inches in diameter. They have 3 of those, granted, but, you know, so their New Riff still size is not too far off from, like, Maker's Mark, what they're using. But, you know, there's only a handful of distilleries that make the majority of the whiskey that's out there. And then you have a distillery in Indiana that makes the bulk of the rye whiskey for every brand, you know, from Redemption to Bullet Rye. So a lot of these brands that you see on the shelf are actually acquiring what we call sourced whiskey from other distilleries and bottling it under their own labels.
So with New Riff, Fred, it's what, going to be about 4 years, though, maybe 4 or 5 years before we ever see a bottle come out of there?
Well, I thought that was going to be the case, but it sounds like they have started to release some whiskey. They've also got that Ranger program where you can sign up and, you know, kind of buy, you know, future stocks of bourbon. And then they also acquire whiskey from that Indiana distillery I was referencing in Lawrenceburg for the OKI brand. And it's kind of interesting that there was actually a tradition in the 1800s, early 1900s of that area acquiring stocks in Indiana and selling it in Ohio and Kentucky in that little region there. And so that actually has a really historical significance to that region. And in fact, really, Cincinnati was very much an important distillery community. I mean, Prohibition, I mean, it crippled that city's ability to make whiskey, but they actually made a good amount of whiskey. And in fact, you had, you know, one of the most important bootleggers in history there, George Remus. But in my research for the book Whiskey Women, I actually found a woman who was running all of these speakeasies in that area. I couldn't find a whole lot of information on her. Her name was just like Miss Tiger. That's how she was referenced. But, you know, she was never caught. But you know, that's a very, very important area for bourbon. And I'm just so thankful to see it getting the credit it finally deserves.
Fred, you know, in terms of surviving Prohibition, wasn't one of the tactics they used was to get a medicinal license for whiskey? So you, hey, we're a medicinal product, not a drink, right?
Now, let's be honest. A lot of people were sick during Prohibition. they needed their whiskey. But, you know, the distillery community at that time was very powerful, very large, and they did, in fact, many of them lobby the rights to have a medicinal license. And so what they would do is that they would sell their existing stocks. And keep in mind, this in much of this time period is before, you know, penicillin, you know, we had just passed the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906. It was really taking play in 1907. So this was a time in our country's history where we were drinking whiskey to cure everything from the footache to the common cold, you know, to your head hurting. So whiskey was used for everything. So the doctors were prescribing a lot of whiskey, and in fact, they basically ran out. So the government granted what was called the distiller's holiday, where they allowed select distilleries to fire up their stills again. And make whiskey for medicinal purposes only, of course. So they were able to, you know, sell the stocks that they had, you know, for the medicinal market, and then they got a little reprieve there to make some additional stuff.
We'll continue our conversation about bourbon, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WV. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. And joining us this afternoon to talk about the wonderful world of bourbon are Cincinnati Magazine dining editor Joanne Drilling, Chef Jackson Rouse from the Rookwood, and author Fred Minnick, who is the bourbon authority for the Kentucky Derby Museum and also writes for several national magazines. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Joanne, did you have any big surprises when you were doing all the research on this?
You know, what was interesting is when we went to the different distilleries, in some ways how different they are. You know, some of them like Buffalo Trace and even Barton's were really big facilities. They still kept kind of a nice small town feel and everything felt quaint, but they were very, very much modern, you know, bourbon making and bottling facilities. But then also sometimes you would go to a place that it was more what we around the office started to call like the Disneyland version of you know, a distillery where they're not really making it. You're not really going to see much in production when you take the tour, because we all went and we all took the tours. But sometimes the benefit of those, and like I was, you know, Heaven Hill is a great example. You really look around and they've got a couple dioramas and they want to show you like a 10-minute video. But when you go there, you really have a chance to try some really expensive small batch bourbons. So you pay like $25. And I mean, you taste things that are several hundred dollars a bottle. So what for a regular person who's maybe not going to sink a couple hundred dollars into a bottle, it's a great way to try some higher end stuff.
And you know, it's interesting, you're talking about the difference in the different distilleries. Woodford, for instance, is a very traditional, very old school kind of place. And then you go to Wild Turkey and you feel like you're in a bourbon factory.
Exactly.
Because everything's stainless steel and it's all new and it's all modern. So there's a lot of different tones and things when it comes to the different distillers.
It's true. And I mean, even when we went to Buffalo Trace, you know, it looks, you know, to borrow a word from my son, old-timey on the outside. But then, you know, they are involved in such state-of-the-art R&D. They have a whole facility there where they are exposing different barrels of bourbon to different conditions, sometimes to the UV light, sometimes to humidity, sometimes to, you know, outdoor air, but not direct sunlight. And they're doing all these different kinds of experiments to kind of try to find this ideal bourbon.
Is that Warehouse X that you're talking about?
Yes. It was fascinating.
Yeah. And I thought that was something from the X-Files or some crazy
thing
like
that.
Yeah.
You go in and there's touch screens and it looks, you know, I mean, there's the barrels and it is this great, you know, old fashioned process. But yet at the same time, you can really see how they're using technology to maximize, you know, for the very best product.
Hey Jackson, can the average person tell the difference between different bourbons, or does it take a while to get your palate educated so you can really taste those differences?
I think it's pretty significant, especially when it comes to age. It's obvious when it depends on, you know, how strong it actually is as well too. I mean, I think definitely. I think I personally like something. I like to have bourbon on the rocks, so I prefer to have something at least 100 proof. Right. And I like straight whiskey a lot just because of that, because I want to be able to sip it. It depends on what kind of bourbon drink that individual is. I mean, there's just so many different variations and nuances of different bourbon. I think that, it's a huge world out there. Bourbon. We have wheated bourbons or rye bourbons. And then, unfortunately, you do have some flavored bourbons, but hey, to each his own. I think that we do a crazy version where we have six different bourbon barrels at work where we actually infuse different flavors into different bourbons and different actual liquors there. And we do our version of Fireball, which we hate, but our version that we actually put like habanero in it and really cool toasted cinnamon. So we have that Fireball effect, but not the awfulness of the Fireball. So we can kind of kitschy, kind of tongue in cheek kind of stuff, or, you know, we call it like a hipster elixir.
There you go.
It is what we do. So,
and Jackson, what would be, if someone were trying bourbon for the first time, what would you recommend?
What would I recommend? Yeah. I personally like Elijah Craig, like 12 year. I think the bang for the buck, I think it's 90-ish proof, a little bit more. It's that one right there. And that's the one I think for the dollar, I think it's amazing. So I like to say, personally, I like stuff 10 years and above, but it just really depends. It really depends. There's so much great bourbon out there. It's hard to Hard to say which one's great.
Well, Joanna Jackson and Fred, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Magazine dining editor Joanne Drilling, Chef Jackson Rouse from the Rookwood, and author Fred Minnick. He's the bourbon authority for the Kentucky Derby Museum. His book, Bourbon Curious, A Simple Guide for the Savvy Drinker, is due out in August. If you'd like to learn more, the final Sunset Salon is tonight at the Clifton Cultural Arts Center. It features a panel discussion on bourbon, and you can find a link to more information on our website. There's also a link to the Cincinnati Magazine article about bourbon at WVXU.org. The Air Force is resurrecting an idea put forth by the Wright brothers, and it involves changing the wing shape to fly more efficiently. WVXU's Ann Thompson reports in Focus on Technology.